Nick Bunker worked as an investigative reporter for the Liverpool Echo, and for 6 years he wrote for the Financial Times. He was an open scholar at King's College, Cambridge, where he won 2 university prizes. He has 2 graduate degrees from Columbia, where he studied under the late Professor Edward Said. While at Columbia, he began his travels around the U.S. For many years, he served as a board member, treasurer, and chairman of the trustees of the Freud Museum in London. He now lives in Lincolnshire, England, near the villages from which the leaders of the Plymouth Colony came. Reviews of Mr. Bunker's book ring with admiration. A bold work of revisionism, says Harper's Magazine. Publishers Weekly writes, Bunker has succeeded in writing a major history, unprecedented in its sweep, of the Plymouth Colony. Never before has such a comprehensive and thoroughly researched study of the subject appeared. The results are stunning. Please welcome Nick Bunker.
Right, thank you very much. Actually, the reviews don't all ring with admiration, but never mind. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I've been in the United States for about 10 days, and I'm going back tomorrow evening, hopefully as long as there are no volcanic ash clouds drifting across the British Isles. But anyway, I've been keeping in touch with things back home, and this afternoon, or this morning, I spoke to my publisher in London, a chap called Will Sulkin, at the Bodley Head, which is the British arm of Random House. And he said, Nick, he said, we've got some good news for you, we've got some bad news. And I said, and he said, which would you like to hear first? And I said, well, I'll have the good news first. And he said, well, the good news is we've had a very large order for 3 boxes of the books from the West Indies. Very large order from a bookstore in Kingston, Jamaica. And I said, that's fantastic. What's the bad news? He said, well, the bad news is they think you've written a biography of Bob Marley. And I said, well, it's obviously the book I should have written, Making Haste from Babylon, Reggae, the Pilgrims, and the Rastafarian Roots of Massachusetts. The first chapter would be No Wampum, No Cry. And the second chapter would be I Shot the Pilgrim. But enough of this. Now, it's very appropriate, and from my point of view, absolutely delightful to be here at the Harvard Bookstore, because I did spend quite a lot of time in this store while I was researching the book. I made 3 trips to New England for research, each one about 3 or 4 weeks in duration. And what I would do is I would work over in the Massachusetts Historical Society or the Boston Public Library or the Massachusetts Archives down at down in the south end of Boston. And then I would come over here in the evening to get something to eat and have a drink, and I would often come into the Harvard Bookstore. And there was one particular section of the Harvard Bookstore that I would tend to focus on, and it, strangely enough, is right here. You see just above the bookshelves there, you'll see Environment and Science, I think it says, or Environment and something. And the reason those shelves were important was because those are the shelves that have on them material related to the coastline of Massachusetts and to the wildlife and the natural history. And there were 2 books there that you'll find referred to in my notes, which were particularly important, oddly enough. One was a book by a man called Mark Burtness, who's a professor at Brown. It's a book called Atlantic Seashores, which is a fabulous book, which I used because it refers so heavily to the salt marshes. And the salt marshes of Massachusetts play a big part in Making Haste from Babylon towards the end. They relate to the importance of salt marshes as a source of grazing for livestock. And the other book was specifically related to Harvard. It's called Forests in Time by Professor David R. Foster. He's the editor, who's the director of the Harvard Forest up at Petersham. And that's a wonderful book too, because it details very scientifically and in great accuracy and very meticulous way the environmental changes that occurred in the last 1,000 years in New England. And that's very important because it's from my point of view, it's essential to be able to sort of step away from impressionistic accounts of landscape and to try and give them some kind of scientific grounding, which is what he's done. And you'll find, again, in my book, you'll find a map towards the end in the final few chapters, which is taken from that book. So that's the kind of thing I was doing. And so, as I say, it's very appropriate for me to be here. Now, what I'd like to do is to start by saying something in general terms about what the book concerns and what it doesn't concern, about the things the book does and those that it doesn't do. Then I'd like to go on to give a specific example from the book of the kind of thing that I've attempted to do by way of widening the narrative and archive sources available. That's concerning a particular episode in the book concerning the original departure of the Pilgrims from the coast of England in 1608. And then towards the end, I'd like to say something about the way the book is written, the style and structure of the book, which is something that's given rise to a bit of comment, because in some ways it's a little bit unusual. Now, in terms of what the book doesn't do, when I was up in Maine, I did a lot of work up in Maine. I met a chap called Dave Cook, who was a past president of the Maine Archaeological Society. He's a great expert on the canoe trails of Maine, which are the canoe carries and the waterways and the routes followed by the Eastern Abenaki people of Maine. And he said to me, he said, Nick, you'll have to be very careful because if this turns out to be a revisionist exercise, you may make yourself unpopular because people don't necessarily want to hear a revisionist account of the pilgrims. And I said, well, to be frank, that's not really a relevant word. The book is not really revisionist because, quite frankly, in the last century or so, there have been great waves of interpretation and reinterpretation that have already crashed over the rocks of most events in colonial history. And so it's a bit hard to say there is any longer any kind of orthodoxy which you can revise. So it's not really revisionist in that sense. Secondly, it's not really an attempt to try and answer any questions about modern America on the basis of what happened 300 or 400 years ago. I'm not trying to say, ask or answer the question, are Americans the way they are today, or is the American psyche the way it is today because it was founded in part by Puritans? That's not the kind of thing I'm trying to do. There was a book published a year or so ago by Sarah Vowell, The Wordy Shipmates, which does exactly that. And I would point anybody in the direction of it because I think it's actually great fun and also dovetails quite nicely with what I've done here. Nor am I trying to take sides. I mean, I hope, sincerely hope, there is no side-taking anywhere in the book in any particular chapter. In fact, as I specifically say, the conflicts of the 17th century are not our conflicts. They are conflicts of a different era and about different issues. So I don't try to take any sides. And I hope I've cleansed out of the book any side-taking at all. So what am I doing? In reality, what I'm doing is something which I think is, in a sense, more humble than those things, but also maybe more audacious, which is this: to try and dramatically to widen the available source material that can be brought to bear upon these events, these critical events, these events that unfolded around, before, during, and after the arrival of the Mayflower in November 1620 in Provincetown Harbour. When I say dramatically widen, what I mean is really in four ways. Now, to begin with, we need to bear in mind that most histories of this period, most colonial histories, are written on the basis of a very narrow range of sources. In this case, in the case of the Plymouth Colony, we're really talking about the narratives of William Bradford and Edward Winslow. Those are the primary sources that have always been the backbone of pretty much all narrative accounts of this period. Secondly, the work of Captain John Smith, because after he came back from Virginia, John Smith did write an enormous amount about North America, including New England, and his works are very important sources which are frequently used, and I have to say are actually pretty reliable in my opinion. There's also the work of Roger Williams, particularly his work about Native American language and Native American customs, which are frequently used, sometimes without attribution, but they are frequently used. And finally, there is the great journal of John Winthrop, which comes a bit later. These really are the sources which provide the backbone of most material. Now, as I say in the book, they're not inaccurate, they're not false, and in very often when you check them out against other sources, they turn out to be surprisingly clear and precise, and also they can be verified. They're not false, but the trouble is they tend to leave a great deal out. So the aim is to find, as I say, these extra sources, and they fall into four categories. The first category, which I'll talk about in a moment, are the archival traces that are still available in the United Kingdom. Now, you might think it's surprising that there are sources that are still available in the United Kingdom that have not been looked at before, but the reason is chronological, really. What happened was that in the latter part of the 19th century, up until about 1920, which was the time, of course, of the 300th anniversary of the Plymouth Colony, which was a very important date, at that period, between about 1870 and the end of the First World War, many scholars from the United States came over to Britain, and they did look as carefully as they could for everything that might be there in the form of unpublished manuscript material. The most famous and the most important was a man called Henry Martin Dexter, who wrote a book published in 1906 called The England and Holland of the Pilgrims, where he did trawl through an enormous amount of material. And there were others, and they looked at material not only relating to the pilgrims, but also relating to early New York, the colonies in the South, and so on. But the difficulty was that at that time, there were large quantities of documents that were not yet available and not accessible, or they just weren't catalogued. Cataloguing being crucial because uncatalogued, unsorted documents are pretty useless, actually. And what's happened since the Second World War is that a lot more material, particularly from private sources, private papers, also papers relating to litigation and papers, in my case, which I found particularly useful, papers relating to taxes, customs, the sea, and so on, those have become available and much more easy to get at. And that essentially is what I've been doing. The second set of material that is immensely useful is archaeological. Now, one of the difficulties with archaeological material is that very often when it's published, if it's published, and very often it isn't published today, it's not easy to get at. For example, some excellent work that's been done up in Maine on the archaeology of the Kennebec River can only be found if you actually go to the Maine State Library in Augusta and you look at these relatively small number of documents that have been produced by archaeologists working for power companies. As there have been hydroelectric projects have been undertaken in Maine, so power companies have been obliged by the state to conduct archaeological investigations. They have a report, but there's probably only one copy. Something similar happens in Britain, where again, because of all the development that's been going on along the side of the Thames in London, real estate development, again, developers are obliged to have archaeological surveys done. They are done, but they're not necessarily easily available. So that's the second set of sources, which is archaeological material. A third set of sources is the scientific work of the kind that I'm referring to, that David Foster's team does at Harvard, the kind of material that you might find in journals with names like the Journal of Biogeography or Estuaries or that kind of journal, the sort of things that you can find in university libraries but aren't that easily available apart from that. And the fourth set, the fourth source, and one which is very important indeed in making Hazard of Babylon, is the terrain itself. I mean, anybody who picks up this book will soon see that there is a great deal of terrain in the book. There was a review on www.salon.com by Laura Miller, and she said that there's a lot of open air in the book, and it's history with gumboots on, and that is true, and that's deliberate. That is absolutely crucial. On both sides of the Atlantic, both along the coast of Massachusetts, which I explored as thoroughly as I could, and also in the areas of England, not far from where I live, where the leaders of the Plymouth colony came from. So those are the kinds of source material one has to try to get at. And what I'd like to do is to explain how this works in one particular instance. There is one particular chapter of this book, chapter 9, called Stallingborough Flats, which contains probably the single most important archival discovery within it. This is, if you're using your restaurant language, this is your Michelin three-star rosette piece of archival discovery. What it is, it relates to an episode that's described by William Bradford in his History of the Plymouth Plantation. In that book, William Bradford describes an episode in 1608, he doesn't actually give the date, but it is 1608, on the coast of Lincolnshire, when 100-odd separatists, people who had come from villages in Lincolnshire and Nottinghamshire and so on, gathered to try and meet a Dutch ship that was going to carry them over to Amsterdam. And this is a very famous episode. I mean, you'll find it, for example, in Nathaniel Philbrick's book about the Mayflower. You'll find it referred to in a few sentences. They gather on the shore. The Dutch ship arrives, but unfortunately, almost at exactly the same time as the Dutch ship arrives, so do the militia, the local militia, under the command of various local officials. And while some of the menfolk among the separatists manage to make their escape, they get out to the Dutch ship on a rowing boat, most of them, women and children especially, are caught on the shore and arrested by the militia. Now, this is a very famous episode. Bradford doesn't give a date, and he doesn't give a precise location. He says it was between the towns of Hull and Grimsby, which are on the Humber estuary on the eastern coast of England. Now, when I first began work on this, I was very struck by a fact that something very odd about this, which is that there is no apparent archival support for this episode in the British public records. You cannot find any documentary evidence from the British side, or from the English side rather this time, about what occurred or whether it did occur. Now, Bradford wouldn't have made up an episode as extraordinary as this, but we need to bear in mind that it was very odd. Separatism, the creed of the pilgrims, this creed whereby you wish to separate entirely from the Church of England and form your own independent Protestant congregation, was very, very rare. And it was exceptionally rare for groups of 50 or 100 people to gather on the coast of Lincolnshire and try and sail across the North Sea on a Dutch ship. Very, very rare indeed. So why does no documentary trace survive? Now, I formed a hypothesis pretty early on, which was this. Now, in England at the time, the executive government was the Privy Council, which reported directly to the king. He was nominally the chair of the Privy Council, but normally didn't attend the meetings, and it would meet every couple of weeks. And Bradford refers to the fact, in passing, that what he called the Lords of the Council became involved in this affair. Now, at the time, the way it worked was that in the southern part of England, the Privy Council dealt with these matters, but in the north of England, they delegated their conduct of affairs to a thing called the Council of the North, which was a kind of subsidiary council based in York, whose records were all completely destroyed during the Civil War. So I assumed that the reason why we can't find documentary evidence for this episode in England was because they'd all been destroyed with the Council of the North. But that really wasn't a terribly convincing explanation, actually, because in fact these events occurred on the south side of the Humber. In other words, they were within the south. So what I did was, at a certain point, I went to the National Archives in London, where I did a lot of the work, and instead of using the catalogue, which doesn't make any reference to this affair, I simply went to the microfilms and trawled through them from beginning to end, through the years 1607 and 1608, which is quite a long job, but not impossible. And after 3 or 4 hours of doing this, and as I'm sure you know if you've used microfilm, it can be extremely tiring and very irritating. You can very easily miss things. After about 3 hours, suddenly I saw a reference to a place called Stallingborough. Now, this immediately caught my interest because I had already studied the coastline of Lincolnshire in the area concerned in some detail, and I knew there was a place called Stallingborough Haven, which was in pretty much the right spot. And if you turn, if you have a copy of Making Haste from Babylon, you will find the Stallingborough depositions. These are a set of depositions, that's what I'd found, which are in the National Archives in London. There's a little picture of them there. And we've actually got them on the Alfred A. Knopf website. If you type in www.knopfdoubleday.com and go from and / Making Haste from Babylon, you will find them. And what they are is the original depositions that were taken. It is indeed the case. The militia had arrested the separatists, exactly as William Bradford described it. The militia had arrived, they had arrested the separatists, they carted them off down the road to Grimsby, which is the nearest town, where they were pulled up in front of two justices of the peace, the principal one being a man called Thomas Hatcliffe, and he signed the depositions. And the depositions record the interrogations of the individuals concerned. And it soon becomes clear why they've not been noticed before. It's because the spellings of the names were so odd. In Jacobean and Elizabethan England, names are often spelt in a kind of anarchic variety of ways. In this case, the key man was a man called Thomas Helwys, who was one of the original Baptists, because one of the interesting aspects of this story, of course, is that Baptists originated from the same area as the Pilgrims. Helwys, the name is usually spelled H-E-L-W-Y-S, but in this case it had been spelled E-L-V-I-S-H. So when people rather lazily, like me initially, looked at the catalogue and the index, they didn't find the name Helwys, they found Elvish and they ignored it. Now what we got, therefore, is a set of depositions, and what they give you is this. They give you the dates, they give you the precise location, they give you the names of the people involved, they give you the numbers involved, and they give you pretty much everything. And the reason that's important is because once you've got that, you can then move off in all directions. Once you have the date, you can then consult the records of the Privy Council itself to find out what else they were doing at the time, and you can find out who was responsible. And we can look at another source, which is the Journal of Robert Cecil. Now, Robert Cecil was the Lord Treasurer. He was the son of the great Lord Burghley, William Cecil. And we actually have a journal, which is also in manuscript form, of his period in office. And from that, we can tell exactly what he was doing at the time. We can also tell exactly where the king was at this particular moment, at that particular week. And the interesting, all sorts of interesting things come out of it. For example, the fact that that week they were mainly preoccupied with Irish affairs. They were primarily dealing with a rebellion in Ireland, in Londonderry, and a rebellion actually in the Bogside in Londonderry, of all places. And we put all this together, what we can create is a much richer and deeper picture of exactly what was going on and exactly what the reasons were and exactly what these episodes contain. So we don't end up by, if you like, showing Bradford to be wrong or proving him to falsify something, but we do end up with something that's a far deeper, richer and fully rounded picture of these events. And I'll just read you a little section of this particular chapter. There it is. And this is how it opens. Chapter 9, Stallingborough Flats. And I just begin with a little epigraph, which is William Bradford's reference to the location. He says, "Between Grimsby and Hull was a large common a good way distant from any town. And that actually is exactly right. It was a common. It was a piece of common land. The land along the side of the river was used as common land for grazing sheep, basically. And that, again, we can tell from other records of the period. And what he says is that, what I say is this. It was May 12th, a cold Thursday, about 4 in the afternoon. The flood tide had peaked. The brown foam of the river had turned to a rapid ebb, and the wind had begun to blow from the higher ground upstream. The moment had come for ships bound down the estuary to slip their moorings and to look for the deep channel towards the open sea. The Frances, a sailing barge built to carry coal, swung at her anchor in the shallows in Stallingborough Haven on the south bank of the Humber. Here a stream flowed slowly down between salt marshes where sheep grazed 3 or 4 to the acre. At the point where it entered the river, the stream carved a deep trench, winding out through the mud of the haven until it merged with the breakers. On the mud, churned into rust-coloured puddles like dung beside a cattle trough, an onlooker would have seen black and white wading birds picking out cockles with their long beaks. Now, every single detail in that is entirely authentic. It could be taken by, first of all, combining William Bradford's account with the account in the depositions. That gives you the date, it gives you the tidal conditions, it gives you the place where it occurred. The name of the barge, the Frances, comes from the depositions. But we can also go to what are known as the port books of Hull, which are just up the coast, which is where she was based, that particular ship. And we can find out how big she was, we can find out what she used to do, and what she used to do was sail up and down the coast taking coal from Newcastle to London. London having a huge demand for household coal that particular year, because that year the winter had been extremely cold. And we've also got the place itself, where we can go, and where I've been, obviously many times. And again, we can be entirely accurate about it, because even the birds do indeed, black and white wading birds, lapwings, do indeed inhabit that particular area of coast. And they must have done for a very long time, because that particular area of the coast is actually known locally as Pywipe Flats. And pywipe is the Lincolnshire dialect word for a lapwing. So basically everything can be reconstructed in this way. And that's really what the book is really all about trying to do, trying to reconstruct these things in as rich and as deep a way as possible and make them as vivid as possible, but all on an entirely authentic basis, not on the basis of kind of speculation or conjecture. But it's also about fitting them into a wider context. Now, I mentioned a moment ago the Irish dimension of this, and that's something which I'm very enthusiastic about, but nobody in Britain's really noticed very much. But maybe people will notice it more in this area, for obvious reasons. All of this happened at the same time as something else. The Pilgrims, we remember as radical Protestants, Puritans, who were fleeing from James I. But there was another group of people who were fleeing from James I, who were of completely the opposite persuasion. That is to say, the Irish earls from Ulster. It is quite remarkable that one of the most famous episodes of Irish history, that is to say the flight of the earls, occurred at exactly the same time as the flight of the pilgrims. If you recall, and it's something which, as I say in the book, is familiar to the Irish, but not necessarily everybody else, there were two Irish earls, the Earl of Tyrone and the Earl of Tyrconnell. And in the latter part of 1607, they fled from Ireland in exactly the same way. They fled from Loch Swilly, which is in Donegal, near to Londonderry. Of course, they went to Rome. But there is an account of the flight of the earls from Ulster, which is very similar, oddly enough, to the account that Bradford gives of the flight of the pilgrims from Lincolnshire. In the case of the pilgrims from Lincolnshire, William Bradford describes the departure and how they sailed across the North Sea, how they very nearly got lost, how they got pushed off course by a storm. They thought at one stage they were going to end up in Norway. And of course, they prayed for assistance, they prayed for guidance, they prayed for salvation until eventually the weather cleared and they finally managed to make it into Amsterdam after 2 weeks. Well, strangely enough, the account of the flight of the Irish earls in the Irish language is very similar. It was written by a man called Tadger Keenan, who was the family historian of the Maguires. It was published in Ireland at Maynooth in 1916, a very appropriate date. And in Irish, it tells a very similar story. In their case, they didn't go across the North Sea. They sailed off down the coast of Ireland, and then they wandered across the Bristol Channel and then into the Bay of Biscay and finally made the coast of France. But similarly, it took them 2 weeks. Similarly, they ended up getting lost in a storm. And of course, they too resorted to religion. In their case, they didn't go down on the knees and pray. What they did was they had some holy relics, and they put him over the side of the ship and dragged him behind it. A rather different way of doing things. It's got a Catholic form of devotion, but similar. And the point I'm making here, really, in the book is this, that we've tended to always to see the pilgrims narrowly in terms of their relation towards America, which is understandable, of course, because the event was of great importance. What I try to do is to put them in the context of other flows of human beings at the time. So in the following chapter, I compare the arrival of the Irish Earls in Rome with the arrival of the pilgrims in Amsterdam, and make comparisons and contrasts between them. Almost it was exactly the same time, something else was happening, which was the expulsion of what were called the Moriscos from Spain. The King of Spain expelled all of those people from Andalusia, from the south of Spain, that is to say, Arabs who had been converted to Christianity often but had remained behind after the reconquest of Granada. He expelled them, hundreds of thousands of them, and they fled to North Africa. So what I was trying to do was to put all these things together in context so that the flight of the pilgrims to America comes to be seen as part of all these much wider dispersals going on of all kinds of different groups being set in motion, if you like. Fundamentally, the underlying theme, I think, had to do with tensions and crises within the state. That is to say, each of the monarchies I'm talking about, England, Spain, and so on, had all sorts of problems of their own to deal with. And one of the ways by which they tried to resort to solving their problems was simply by getting rid of anybody who they found a bit awkward. But I tried, as I say in the book, to put all these things together so that suddenly the events of 1620 that are so familiar to Americans suddenly become part of some bigger picture, so that they get a resonance which also appeals to the English, or indeed the Irish in this case. They can all be seen as part of a much wider passage of a much wider process of mobilization, if you like, that was occurring at the time. That's fundamental to what I was doing in the book. Now, I'll just say a word about the conclusions of the book before I talk about the structure of it. There's a lot in this book. It's a long book. It's 400 pages. And there are a lot of questions that are being asked and answered. There are two really big questions that are asked and answered in the book, taking it very broadly. One is the question of what I call the long hesitation. If you recall, Columbus, of course, sailed across the Atlantic in 1492, and at roughly the same time, the first English sailors were fishing around the Grand Banks off Newfoundland. Indeed, there was a British scholar called David Quinn who actually thought that the British had got to Newfoundland before Columbus got to America, and it is conceivable. And yet it took 130 years before the English actually made a go of permanent settlements in North America. Jamestown had been founded in 1607, but the fact is that it took 15 or 20 years before Jamestown actually became secure and permanent. It suffered terribly from loss of life in its early years. It was shaky financially. It was riven, the Virginia Company at home in London was riven with all kinds of conflicts and schisms. And eventually it had to be taken over by the state and dissolved and reconstituted. So it took a long time. So the question is, why was there this long hesitation? Why did it take so long for the English to become committed to North American colonization? And to get at that question, you have to talk, as I do in the book, a great deal about politics, about economics. You have to ask why it was that there was a whole set of incentives that suddenly came together in the 1620s. Economic incentives, the fact that England was losing its competitive battle with the Dutch in the East Indies. That is to say, the Dutch East India Company was essentially outgunning and outmaneuvering the English East India Company. You have to talk about, for example, the real estate market in England. I mean, the reality was that by far the most important form of activity for everybody was agriculture, and therefore by far the most important form of investment was speculation in land. So in a sense, it was only when rents started to fall and the price of land started to level off that people actually felt it was important to go to America. And of course, also you have to talk about religion, and you have to talk about a convergence of circumstances at the end of the 1620s where religion and politics came together. And this again is a major theme of the book. Religion and politics came together to make New England a necessity rather than just an option. And finally, you come to one of my favourite subjects, which is one which English reviewers have been a bit baffled about, which is the beaver fur trade, which is, again, a major preoccupation of the book, to show exactly why it was that the trade in beaver skins was fundamental, and the trade in beaver skins was, if you like, the factor that made New England. When the price of beaver skins shot up at the end of the 1620s, at a time when the pilgrims had managed to get up into Maine and generate sources of supply on the Kennebec River, that was the moment when New England became both possible at the same time it had become essential. And the second big question is, how did that relate to the Massachusetts Bay Colony? Because this, of course, is one of the great questions that Americans often ask me. What was the relationship between the two? And I've tried to elucidate that as well. My feeling is that most of the accounts that have been written of this on both sides of the Atlantic have not really explained properly how the two are related. And what I've shown here is how the men who launched the Massachusetts Bay Colony were watching the Plymouth Colony with great interest. And it was when the Plymouth Colony in 1628, 1629 began to show that it was definitely going to work, that they definitely had a model that could be made to succeed, then suddenly they pursued the same model and they followed the Plymouth Colony across the Atlantic. Now, the reason this is important is because the tendency has been over here, I think, particularly at Harvard, actually, where Perry Miller, the great Harvard professor, was really the exponent of this way of thinking, the tendency has been to regard the Plymouth Colony as a rather kind of quaint, but relatively unimportant and minor entity, whereas what I argue is that it was the essential prototype, and it was only when the Plymouth Colony showed what could be done that the Massachusetts Bay colonists came flooding over in their thousands in the early 1630s. Now, just finally, before I take questions, what I'd like to talk about is the way the book is written and the structure of it. Now, there are various ways you could try and write about the Plymouth Colony and the early colonization of New England. You could try to write a very straightforward narrative history, starting at 1610 or 1615 or wherever you want to start, and finishing off in 1630 or 1640 or wherever you want to stop. You could do it in terms of a blow-by-blow, day-by-day or month-by-month account, following strictly in chronological order. The trouble with that is you have your problem, which is that the sources which I described earlier, the narrative sources, Winslow, Bradford, and so on, leave such an enormous amount out. They just don't tell you a lot of the things you need to know. Things you need to know about navigation, things you need to know about the beaver fur trade, all kinds of things are simply left out, often simply because they took it for granted that you'd know it already. So it's difficult to do that. It's also important, I think, to bear in mind that we need to be honest about this and to recognize that there are many, many big gaps which are never going to be filled. And that the job of reconstructing the history of a period such as this is not an easy one. It has to be done piecemeal. It has to be done by assembling a kind of mosaic of fragments, each one put alongside each other so they shed light on each other and eventually produce a much bigger picture. And if you're going to do that, it really is a bit spurious to try and pretend you can just write a continuous narrative. There are periods of history for which you can do that. You can be David McCulloch writing about John Adams or whatever. You can do that for the later period where the material is extremely rich in relation to the Revolutionary War, for example. But I think to pretend you can do it for the 17th century is not really correct. So what I've done here is something else. The book occasionally stops and goes around a bit of a circle where you deal with these sorts of issues I'm talking about, the beaver fur trade or whatever. It starts in 1628 with the critical turning point, that moment on the Kennebec River where they found the beaver skins they needed. Then it goes back to the foundation of the actual project and to the voyage of the Mayflower. And then it goes back even further into the deep origins of the affair, deep origins of the Plymouth Colony in the politics of Elizabethan England. And then from there it goes forward straight through to the critical moment at the end of the 1620s when the colony became secure and when it gave birth to the much bigger migration in Massachusetts. But the structure of the book is deliberately constructed like this in order, if you like, to sort of lead you into this complicated process of reconstruction of the historical reality so that you actually follow, if you like, the process by which the historian writes the book. That's the intention of it. It also has a literary model, actually. The literary model is Joseph Conrad, which is exactly what Joseph Conrad used to do. And the reason why I did that was because Joseph Conrad is particularly relevant here, because Conrad's books deal with so many of the same issues. Conrad, as I'm sure you remember, was writing at the end of the 19th century about issues to do with imperialism and so forth, about colonialism. He was writing about the interplay between ideology, religion, history, politics, the sea. And it seemed to me appropriate to use a kind of Conradian model in writing the book. Now, that's really all I was going to say, except to thank the Harvard Bookstore again. And I'd be delighted to take any questions at all. So, because the case of Stephen Hopkins is particularly interesting because of the Virginia connections. Now, I think it's quite important to recognize that I don't see Virginia and the Plymouth colonies being opposed to each other in any way. I mean, the Plymouth colonists wanted Virginia to succeed. Virginia colonists wanted Plymouth Colony to succeed, because if both succeeded, there was much more chance of getting a very flourishing oceanic traffic going on, because both sides, both colonies, needed to have as many ships as possible visiting. And the critical problem for them initially was not enough ships were coming across the Atlantic. If you look at the English customs records, which are very important for this, you'll find that the number of ships coming over in 1617, 1618 was maybe only half a dozen a year. And of course, that was dangerous, because if you didn't have lots of ships coming over, then there was a danger that you would not be able to get the supplies you needed. So I think the Hopkins story is a very important one. But as I say, I decided not to deal with it, because Caleb Johnson has done a fabulous job in it as well. No, I was brought to it by reading William Bradford, because Bradford, I mean, obviously, yes, that's some of the most important sources are the Dutch sources, particularly those that were found in the notarial records in Amsterdam, which do record the Dutch trade in great detail. There was a book written called The Prehistory, I think, of New Netherland, which was done in like the 50s, which has a lot of material on that. But I was interested by Bradford, because what happens in Bradford's narrative is when you get to a certain date, 1626, because he arranges the history of the Plymouth Plantation by years, and when you get to 1626, 1627, suddenly you come upon lots and lots of references to the beaver fur trade, and it makes it very clear that that was the turning point. Now, the problem is that in England itself, the available sources about the fur trade appeared to be very, very limited. I mean, virtually nothing. I mean, nothing has been written about it in England. A lot has been written about the Netherlands, of course, as you say, about the New Netherland trade, but virtually nothing in the UK. Also, a lot has been written about the French fur trade because of Champlain, the huge documentation of Champlain. Now, what happened in my case was that I was very fortunate to find a book by a French author, a man called Bernard Allaire. He was a French-Canadian author, and he wrote an excellent book about the French-Canadian fur trade using the notarial records from France. To show how the price of beaver felts changed. So what I thought to myself was, well, maybe there's a way we can find something similar in England. And what I did was I thought, well, probably the best source would be wardrobe accounts. That is to say, the wardrobe accounts of the king, because they will show the purchase of beaver hats. And we might be able to chart the movement of beaver fur prices. And that's what I did, basically. I went for wardrobe accounts. And once I had the wardrobe accounts of James I, actually it was Charles I, his son, once I had those, and we had the names of the haberdashers and some idea about how the price moved, then from there I could sort of reconstruct it. But the beaver fur trade is in England is something which prior to this book has hardly been written at all. All the material, as you rightly say, has been Dutch or French, and most of it is very rich. What I also used here was the customs records. The English customs records, what I call the port books, are very, very comprehensive. There are 1,500 of them survived from the reign of James I, and this is probably the first book that uses them in real detail for this kind of thing, and they show the movements of beaver skins. And then what you do is you have to take all the things I described and match them up with what William Bradford says, and then you end up with something that's quite comprehensive. And then you go back to the Dutch sources or the French sources and see how they compare with those two. So it's quite a long process, but it ended up, reasonably clear. Well, of course, eventually the English attacked the Dutch, but that was the other way around. But yes, of course. I mean, and what the Dutch attempted to do basically was to fob the Plymouth colonists off by feeding them a bit of beaver fur. But the reason why the English went up the Kennebec River was precisely because the Dutch were on the Hudson, the French were on the St. Lawrence, and the Kennebec provided a space between the two. But the really big conflict was with the French, not the Dutch. The English really did fight a war with the French, and of course, and between 1629 and 1632, the English actually occupied Quebec. So it was really the French that were the public enemy, if you like. We talk about two different instances. One was 1608 when they fled from England to go to Holland, and then 1620 when they go over to America. In 1618, when James I was asked to give his approval, he said yes. And I think the reason for that was simply by that stage, separatism was not really a big threat in England. I mean, separatism had receded out of the picture. It simply wasn't a major issue. There just weren't very many separatists making trouble in England. And James I felt really secure about that. But also it's because they had a value. You see, 1618, the first problem was the Virginia colony was in trouble. Jamestown simply wasn't performing. The number of colonists wasn't adequate. And the men who ran the Virginia colony, the men who ran Jamestown from London, needed reinforcements. Second point was that in 1618, James I had recently had to change his administration. He had appointed a whole series of new ministers at the beginning of 1618, most of whom were navalists. They were men who were committed to naval grand strategy. And they saw New England, as far as I can see, this is my interpretation, but I think it's about as accurate as you can get, they saw New England as essential for naval bases and for naval stores. And so they were quite happy to say to the pilgrims, off you go. plus, of course, also their rivals with the Dutch. There were rivalries with the Dutch. And so if the pilgrims were going to do what they originally intended, which was to land on the Hudson River, then it was a way, if you like, of stealing a march on the Dutch. And there was a final incentive, which, of course, was the Northwest Passage. The men who ran the Virginia Company, particularly a man called Sir John Wolstenholme, who was one of James I's advisors, honestly believed, and this was not unreasonable, really, that you could find a way to the Pacific via the Hudson River and the Great Lakes. And again, therefore, it was important to position Englishmen in what they called the northern parts of Virginia in order, again, to prevent the Dutch or the French from forestalling us, we English, shall we say, from finding that Northwest Passage route. So those are the kind of reasons. But I don't think, to be honest, I don't think in 1618 James I would have actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. I think he just gave it his blessing and went off to do something else. The title comes from, it's a quotation. When John Winthrop in 1629 was deciding whether or not to go to America, he took a lot of advice and he consulted a lot of friends of his. And he had letters. He received various letters from friendly Puritans. And this particular letter was written by a man called Robert Rice, who was a Puritan in Essex. And what he said was, he was giving reasons to go to America. He said, cruelty and blood is in our streets. The land aboundeth with murders, slaughters, incests, adulteries, whoredom, drunkenness, oppression, and pride. Even the least of these is enough, and enough to make haste out of Babylon. And the reason I chose it was because it just leapt out at me as soon as I saw it, but also because there was a sense of urgency and speed about it, which is what I wanted, to get the sense of people feeling impelled to travel across the Atlantic, feeling actually driven to do so, whereas before it had simply been an option, now to become a necessity. But in fact, that quotation actually, by Rice's comments, actually they come originally, he's quoting from the book of Jeremiah. I think it's Jeremiah chapter 53, which uses the same language. And of course, it's comparing the captivity of the Israelites. What Rice essentially is doing is comparing the captivity of the Israelites in Babylon to the captivity, as he saw it, of the Puritans in England. So that's ultimately where it comes from. Well, yeah, this is one of those things. It's like things that our nation is being divided by a common language. And the reason I put right at the beginning, there's an author's note which explains the way I use the term. If you're writing about this in England, then we think of Puritans and Puritanism as being a religious movement with a political dimension that came into being in the mid-1560s as a protest against Elizabeth I's way of running the church, and then ended totally in the early 1660s because of the defeat of Puritanism with the restoration of Charles II. And then in England, Puritanism stops at that point. Now, from an English point of view, Puritanism is this, as I say, this religious movement with political overtones. And we would see separatists as being a kind of subgroup within Puritanism. Now, in America, you've got a completely different situation, where here, Puritanism went on into later in the 17th century and on into the 18th century, and there's no really clear end to it. And also, it wasn't simply, you know, precisely. And for Americans, of course, particularly in New England, it's very important to tell the difference between the Plymouth colonists on the one hand and the Massachusetts Bay Colony on the other, because different things happen in each place. So from an American point of view, you want to draw a difference between the Puritans of Boston and the Separatists of Plymouth, whereas from an English point of view, we would simply see them as being, the Separatists as being the kind of like cutting edge of Puritanism, a subgroup within it, and just the most radical element. Now, the trouble with this is it's a bit hard to use the language without, if you like, confusing somebody. So what I've done at the beginning of the book is explain exactly how I use the term. But I know it can be a bit confusing, yes.